Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc forum called Immigration and the Question of State Invasion. Unfortunately, due to technical difficulties, Professor Soman will not be joining us today, but we are joined by the Honorable Ken Cuccinelli, who will do his best to represent both sides of the debate. We're also joined by Joseph Heumeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for a Secure Free Society, who will be moderating the discussion today. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speaker, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we welcome the audience to ask questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Joseph, thanks for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you, Edith. First of all, it's a pleasure to be able to host, I think, really what a timely debate. Well, at least a portion of the debate. I think after November 5th, and actually before November 5th, but particularly the question, I think, on a lot of people's mind, both within the U.S. national security community, within the policymaking community, but I think just every American throughout the country, is what's going to be done about the problem of illegal immigration, about the problem of the border insecurity, and all these second and third order effects that takes place in our country. And I think we're looking forward to a lively debate, but I think we're going to be able to have a lively discussion with our speaker at this point, who I think is a very qualified and very distinguished to talk about this specific issue, who will also do his best to talk about the other side of the debate. And we hopefully will in the future be able to talk with Professor Elias Soming about this as well. I should say that there's going to be a cute question and answer box in your Zoom that you can ask questions throughout the debate. We'll be have a portion towards the latter part of the discussion where we would address those questions directly. And without further ado, let me introduce our speaker, who is Mr. Ken Cuccinelli, who has held many jobs and many titles. You can read his full biography on the Federal Society website. But I'll highlight a few things that I think are really relevant to today's discussion. He had served, and I should say this very proudly, as a resident, lifelong resident of Virginia, as the Attorney General of Virginia from the period of 2010 to 2014. And as for those that live in Virginia, we know that that encompasses a wide portfolio, perhaps more than other states, which includes counterterrorism, counter-transnational organized crime, and actually national threats that manifest within the Beltway of Northern Virginia. He also served under the initial Trump administration as the Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security and Director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, which is the premier agency for immigration in the country. And he is currently a senior fellow for Homeland Security and Immigration at the Center for Renewing America. And there's a much longer list of titles and accomplishments that Mr. Cuccinelli has had. So I think we're privileged to be able to be with you, Ken. And I appreciate you taking this kind of tool-hatted role of being able to debate yourself, so to speak. But we'll kick this off, and I'll ask a question because, you know, when I was thinking about the construct of the question of this debate, I think there was like a premise that we're sort of working with, and that premise I'm going to address to you, and I think we could kick it off from there. That premise, I think, is, while it's maybe obvious for some, it may not be obvious for everyone, which is the United States being invaded by illegal immigration? And you can define the term invasion to any which way you think is most suitable. And so with that, Ken, we'll pose the question, then we'll kick off the conversation. Over to you.
So the invasion powers, or dealing with invasions under the Constitution, is first done by the states themselves in Article 1. By first, I'm going through the Constitution, and I'll come back to that, Article 1, Section 10. And then the federal government is obliged to protect all of the states against invasion in Article 4, Section 4, more commonly known as the Republican Form of Government Clause, It is included there, and I'll come back to that one as well. On numerous occasions, states have sued the federal government to protect them from invasions of illegal aliens. And on all of those occasions, the courts have found the question to be one left to the political branches, that it is non-justiciable, which is a very important consideration. But the first thing in the Constitution is that Article 1, Section 10 power of the states. And I'm going to focus first and primarily on the power of the states that they retain to defend themselves under the Constitution, and then also address who gets to decide questions like the one you just asked, are we being invaded? And with respect to the exercise of the state's power to repel those invasions. And as you've heard me mention at the federal level, my hint here is that it is all non-justiciable, which may sound boring for lawyers, but I actually think it's pretty important. And I'll note at the outset, because we were also, when we set this discussion up, we were also talking about the Alien Enemies Act. And I'll note at the outset that there's a key difference between the state's power to defend themselves and the Alien Enemies Act. And that's that the Alien Enemies Act only applies vis-a-vis the citizens of a nation, of nation states as nation states, and only those that can be characterized as hostile. Whereas the Article 1, Section 10 power of states to defend themselves, and I'll read that clause here in a moment, applies against any and all invaders of a state, regardless of whether or not they're associated with a government. The part of Article 1 we're talking about here is literally at the very end of Article 1. It's Section 10, Clause 3, most commonly known as the Compacts Clause. No state shall, without the consent of Congress, engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. So without congressional consent, a state can engage in war, meaning use war powers, when they are actually invaded. So if the states, border states in particular, are actually being invaded, they have all the powers to wage war available to them with no one's permission, within most particularly the federal government nor the courts. The states retained their power of self-defense in the formation of the Constitution, and not just against nation states invading, but against anyone invading their states. And when the source of a state's authority comes directly from the Constitution itself, then the Supremacy Clause does not restrain or subordinate the exercise of a state's power. Put differently, there is no higher law or authority than a state when that state is exercising its constitutionally explicated power. We're used to thinking of the Supremacy Clause in state laws and constitutions are subordinate to the federal laws and constitution, but this power comes directly to the states from the federal constitution. So the Supremacy Clause does not restrain the states. We've talked about Virginia, as we always should. In the Virginia Ratification Convention, the author of the Constitution himself, James Madison, who is, I'm sure, on many of your ties, since you're watching a Federalist Society event, I'm sure you all wore your James Madison tie. I wore my Center for Renewing America tie. But James Madison used the example of smugglers to explain how this provision of the Constitution leaves states able to protect themselves without having to get permission from the federal government. At that same convention, arguably the most impactful legal mind in the history of the United States, John Marshall, defended at length both the position that the states retained the right to self-defense against invasion and that it is up to each state themselves to decide when the use of that power is necessary. Pretty ironic that in 1788, John Marshall was already arguing non-justiciability. Little did he know. In the modern age, Justice Scalia stated in his concurring opinion in the landmark Arizona versus U.S. case that the state self-defense clause, quote, leaves intact states' inherent power to protect their territory, unquote. And I would remind folks that the illegal aliens involved in that case were just generic. There weren't specific people, there weren't specific individuals involved. They were generic illegal aliens, not from any particular nation. And I ought to know, when I was AG of Virginia, I filed an amicus brief in the case on this subject. Because each state has the constitutional authority to defend itself, it necessarily follows that the commander in chief of each state, in other words, the governor, has the sole power to decide when his state is actually being invaded or is in imminent threat of such invasion. In fact, when Mark Brnovich was the attorney general of Arizona, he was asked in an official opinion this very question, and he answered the question that Arizona was being invaded. This was back in early 2022 when the opinion was issued. And he also opined that the commander in chief, Governor Ducey, had the authority to repel that invasion. That is actually the most formal legal opinion, because there are no court opinions directly on point on this subject. Here in 2025, I think the American people already believe that the flow of illegal aliens over our southern border is an invasion. I'm very confident of that. And I think they're right as a matter of law. Nonetheless, whether I'm right or the American people are right or whether we're wrong, it is the governor of each border state that has the constitutional authority to decide whether or not his or her state is being invaded. And if so, then that governor can use the war powers, may use war powers to repel that invasion without the approval of or notice to anyone else, including the federal government. Now, just to be clear, as a practical matter, this doesn't mean tanks and planes invading Mexico. It just means putting manpower in place to block the entry or to grab those who enter and return them back across the international boundary using prisoner of war powers, not immigration law. There's been litigation over the corresponding invasion clause of Article 4, Section 4 that I mentioned earlier. That section requires the federal government to protect the states against invasion. The fact that that exists doesn't mean the states can't protect themselves. And the cases under Article 4, Section 4, as I said, have all been states suing the federal government to compel the federal government to protect that state from the invasion that was asserted to be going on. And all of the courts have held the question as one committed to the political branches. They've also held that there are no workable judicial standards to apply. In other words, the question is non-justiciable. And decisions along those lines have happened in the 2nd, 3rd, 9th, and 11th circuits. They've never gone to the Supreme Court, but there's never been a circuit split either. I would note that a case did go to the Supreme Court in 1849 under the Republican form of government portion of Article 4, Section 4. That case is Luther v. Borden, and it came out of Connecticut in a dispute over which was the actual government of the state. And the Supreme Court ruled that it did not have the authority to rule, that that was a question deposited to Congress, which Congress had in the Militia Act delegated to the president. And the court did not have a role in deciding whether which government was the appropriate one, that was left to Congress and the president. So on the one occasion when any similar case has gone to the Supreme Court found that it was in fact a decision for the political branches, and here the political branch would be the state government. Just one last word on the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. I really don't find it to be the most useful tool, even for what promises to be a very aggressive Trump administration. The Alien Enemies Act authorizes the president to arrest, imprison, and deport all natives, citizens, denizens, or subjects of hostile foreign nations as alien enemies during time of war, invasion, incursion, or threats thereof. So even if you could say we're being invaded, I'm not sure you could make that case and connect it to a specific country as conducting the invasion. You might be able to say drug cartels are, but the federal government used the Alien Enemies Act in the War of 1812, World Wars I and II, and the federal courts, including the Supreme Court, have upheld the constitutionality of the Alien Enemies Act. And while I believe that a loose notion of what constitutes a hostile foreign nation could at least arguably include, say, a Venezuela or Cuba, just to focus on this hemisphere, I think given all the other tools available to the president, I think the Alien Enemies Act is probably more trouble than it's worth. Mm. I would point out on the other side of the state self-defense argument, the two arguments normally made on the other side are one, that in fact, invasions refer only to invasions by nation states. And two, as was recently raised in a dissenting opinion in the Fifth Circuit, where this question wasn't addressed by the majority, but the dissent said that yes, it's a political question. Yes, states can defend themselves, but only for so long as it takes the federal government to be notified and respond. And they didn't speculate as to how long that was. And they obviously didn't draw that from the text of the Constitution because that's not in there. But those are the two arguments that are typically made in opposition to the border states exercising their self-defense authority under Article 1, Section 10. So, Joseph, you had some other questions, and I'm happy.
That's a good point to move forward a little bit, because I think you did a great job answering the question of what the state's powers are to deal with this kind of problem, implying that there is obviously a problem that could be inferred as an invasion of illegal immigrants into the United States. The natural, I think, question from there comes: invaded by who? And you kind of alluded to it in your question, because it's a collection of both state and non-state actors that are probably all benefiting from what's happening to our southern border, and also what's happening in general with illegal immigration. But I think that to answer that question, we're going to get there, but I think to answer that question, we kind of have to visit a question about national security in the sense of, can illegal immigration be used as a tool by state and non-state actors to erode the sovereignty of a nation state? Is there a precedent for this? Has this happened before? Or are we kind of now breaching into something very new in terms of warfare? And I think that that's the question that I think would allow us to then understand the who may be potentially invading the United States.
Right. So, of course, there's no one answer to who's invading the United States. But unfortunately, with an open border policy like the Biden administration has had for 4 years, everybody can come in and they welcome them all. And let's set aside the numerically largest portion, which we'll just call economic migrants, people who just want to live here, but they're skipping the line on legal immigration. China has dealt with us on a very strategic basis. Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran have long talked about targeting the United States. There's every reason to believe that they have used the open border to move some of their folks into the United States. If you look at Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7th of 2023, they began preparing for that 17 years before, when they got control of the Gaza Strip. All the money, international money, all the resources that were provided, 17 years they built and waited and planned. They're very patient. They think in very, very long terms, which is not common for even the national security environment and community in the United States, much less the political community. So we're going to be paying the price on a security basis for the open border for decades to come. And it's going to trickle in here and there. There'll be radicalization that happens because of the open border. And there's also, of course, the criminal pieces. Let's take one of those, Tren de Aragua. So this is a new gang from Venezuela that has they've accomplished, to use the gang perspective, in just a matter of a few years what it took MS-13 about 20 years to accomplish in terms of their aggressive entrance into the United States. And this is a gang that has done the dirty work of Maduro in various countries around the hemisphere. They've performed hits. They've murdered people at Maduro's behest. That's the intelligence belief in parts of South and Central America. And they are a quasi arm, sort of the brown shirts arm of the Maduro government internationally. There's every reason to think that we're not just seeing another criminal gang come into the United States, but they're a criminal gang that also will do the bidding of the Venezuelan government, that the U.S. government now says, even the Biden administration says, you lost the election. How about that? The Biden administration says somebody lost an election. That presents very serious concerns, though perhaps not as serious as, say, the Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran relationship and China. When you look at the population that comes across that border, it is overwhelmingly military-aged males from around the world. So we have numerous different types of sovereignty and security problems that we're now going to be living with for years to come because of the open borders. So unfortunately, the answer to your question is yes. The details of it are complicated and they go in many different directions, but you're absolutely right to be concerned about that strategic impact of the open borders policies we've lived with.
No, thank you. I'm going to exert a little bit of moderator privilege to just kind of add on a little bit to what you're saying, Ken, being that I've done some of this work myself, particularly on Tren de Aragua, and a little bit of shameless self-promotion. I did recently publish a paper with the Heritage Foundation about the TDA. But in essence, what I wanted to share with the participants is, you know, some of the work that I've done over the years on weaponized migration really kind of illuminated my thinking on it. When I came across academic literature from the political science field about what they would call at the time coerced engineered migration. So there's these professors and academics, mostly from the Northeast universities, Harvard, Princeton, that looked at about 81 instances in which smaller and relatively weaker nation states used immigration as a method of coercion against surrounding larger nation states to get concessions. And so they documented 81 instances since the 1951 UN Refugee Convention, which in many respects provided the impetus for asylum on many countries. And if you look at it, those cases, it's very interesting because the concessions were anything from lifting of a sanction, recognizing an election. In some cases, it was international aid that they were looking to get. So there was a range of concessions that they would look for. But what I found most compelling as a method of coercion, and you know, for those that, you know, of us that study warfare is nothing more than compulsion. It not necessarily involves nation states. It's just the ability to compel your adversary to bend to your political will. That's, as Sun Tzu would say, the art of war. And in that respect, what I found interesting was—
Sun Tzu would also say the less violence you can use to achieve the goal, the better, the more successful you are.
Correct. And, you know, it's very much kind of an Eastern philosophy of the war begins not when the first shot is, the war begins way before any military gets involved. But to that, just around that point out, what was most interesting in looking at this was that the success rate as a method of coercion, and you could argue that U.S. sanctions or international sanctions are also a method of coercion in regard to changing behavior of other nation states, that they argued that it was successful 60% of the time. That's a very high success rate in terms of getting concessions. Wow. Sanctions, for those that are in the threat finance domain, it usually only works in terms of changing behavior about 35, 40% of the time if you're lucky. So this, in many respects, could be an even more effective method than actual financial punitive measures that is used, I think, is more commonly used within the arsenal of U.S. National security. So, Ken, you want quick thoughts on that? And then we actually do have some questions from the audience.
Right. Austin. Yeah. So I do think that, look, I study negotiation. There are a lot of litigators on here. Part of our job is negotiation. Negotiation isn't something properly done that you just wing it. You plan the steps and you look for leverage points And you're describing circumstances between nation states where it's really, I don't want to say a zero sum game, but it's clearly a negative leverage. When lawyers are, say, deal making, the ideal outcome is you find win-win situations, right? So it's good for you and it's good for me. There, you've got a nation in a weaker bargaining position, typically, right? And they are determining what's the lesser of the evils I'm being confronted with, typically, would be my expectation. You're more the expert here than I. And there's no question that not just countries, the drug cartels in Mexico utilize not just the existence of illegal migration, but also literally the direction where it goes on the map. So we know they control the south side of that border. They will control where a particular caravan may hit the US border to suck up Border Patrol assets and run drugs or more valuable cargo on another part of the border because now it's less or undefended. And there's lots of ways that illegal migration can be used as a leverage point or to achieve, in their case, business ends or national goals.
Yeah, makes sense. So at this point, Kim, we're going to turn to the audience and I'm going to paraphrase. You can see the question probably in your chat box in the Q&A right. box, but I'll paraphrase a question that came in from David Chu, and forgive me if I mispronounce the name, but essentially it goes to the heart of the supply and demand aspect of illegal immigration. And most of what we've been talking about to this point is the supply side, right? There's plenty of reasons why people want to leave their countries, hardship, immigration, economic, natural disasters. And then there's wars that people are fleeing. And then there's obviously actors, whether state or non-state actors, will manipulate those circumstances to be able to send them in sometimes very organized ways. Caravans are an example. But the question that's asked by David Choi is, what do we do about the demand side of this equation, the pull factors, which most are coming from companies that hire undocumented or illegal workers. The penalties for those oftentimes aren't enforced, or if they are enforced, they're not followed up on, and deportations don't follow soon after. And he gives an example of COVID when cross-border immigration came to still. He said that that basically we solved the demand side, at least for a period of a little bit of a year. So the question, I guess, was what do we do about the demand for those that are incentivizing illegal immigration, either through employment or basically maybe through other means of basically finding ways to find people to come to the United States without going through the legal pathways?
Well, let me correct a misunderstanding about the COVID period. Yes, there was economic disruption in the United States, as we all know, but that was relatively short-lived. If you looked at the tools we used starting in March of 2020 to stop illegal border crossings, we use Title 42, as it's known, a public health order at the border that was in place until about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. And it was extremely effective. We got to the point where we were literally turning around over 90% of illegal border crossers and having them back in Mexico in under 2 hours. That's an extraordinary logistical accomplishment. And it really was because we streamlined, I'll call it, eliminated a lot of the procedural hurdles that our agents normally have to contend with. So yes, there was disruption in the U.S. economy, but not disruption that would account for the how low we could push the numbers down on illegal border crossings in 2020. That really came from the arrangements we made in the security arena and the procedural hurdles we were able to avoid. Having said that, there's no question that you could say this about illegal drugs too. As long as the demand exists, there are gonna be people gonna try to supply that demand. One of the changes that is critical for the Trump administration to make is to turn the 5,000 Homeland Security investigators, these are HSI agents, as you would typically hear them called, on to enforcing the work restrictions. And that also means going after the companies that David is talking about. If I'll give you an example from the first Trump administration, in the summer of 2019, we had the biggest single workplace operation of the Trump administration, about 680 arrests, as I recall, at a bunch of chicken plants in Mississippi. They also charged American citizens who were managing that company with violating the law. And that was critically important. Of course, those jobs were now suddenly open, and there could hardly be a less desirable job than working in a chicken plant. But there is no such thing as a job Americans won't do. The following week, they had a job fair because they had a whole lot of openings. And again, this Mississippi, they had a flood of poor blacks and whites who were ecstatic to have those jobs on the same terms that previously the illegal aliens had been working for. And we saw the data in 2019, not just related to this incident, but in addition to President Trump's tax cuts and deregulation, his emphasis on enforcing immigration law resulted in more job opportunities for poor Americans, and their wages went up. If you look at the data at the end of 2019, we reached the lowest level in the poverty rate in American history since that statistic was kept. And that was because Donald Trump's policies made available work and wage opportunities for the poorest Americans because of the enforcement of immigration law. So I think David is onto something obviously there that's very important. There are a lot of tools there. I would say that's not necessarily a consideration that a governor would make when on our base question of, you know, when can a state governor repel the invasion at their own border? But it's an important question in the broader issue of the immigration question. And I think we're going to hear a lot about that from the Trump administration pretty quickly next week.
Good to go. We may actually have connected our other panelists, but I'll give him a little time to get connected and get his bearings. I'm going to address one of the question, Ken, for you before we go to Ilya, who I think is connected now. And I thought this was an interesting question by Andrew Yurcho that talks about what, you know, you very articulated, very well articulated the state powers to deal with this sort of phenomenon. But what happens when one state deems a certain immigration issue as an invasion, but the other state does not? How do that conflict between the interpretation of the problem clash? Who decides in the end who's correct? What's the process for something when you have different states that perceive or interpret this in different ways?
So there was never any requirement put in the Constitution for states to coordinate their responses. Remember, the states that made the federal Constitution had all of the powers of nations. That's what the Declaration of Independence said. And they were operating as sovereigns when they created the federal government. They retained this power of self-defense in Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3. The fact that one governor uses it does not in any way impair another governor in similar circumstances' ability to use it. There isn't an outside decider because it's a non-justiciable question. It is left to the governors of each of the states to decide for themselves, one, whether they're being invaded or not, and two, whether they do anything about it, and then three, exactly what they do about it.
Sounds good. I believe we confirmed that we do have Ilya, Professor Ilya Sohman, connected now by phone. And so for those, I won't go through his bios for sake of time, but for those that don't know him, he's a professor at the Anthony Law, Scalia Law School at George Mason University. It's a pleasure to have you connected, Professor. What I'll do is I'll do a quick recap and then give you the same question I gave to A.G. Cuccinelli at the beginning of this debate. So far we've covered, and what Ken has done is essentially articulate a lot about what the state powers are when it comes to repelling illegal immigration beyond immigration powers, but war powers as being interpreted as an invasion. And then we talked a little bit about who those invaders could potentially be and how that works within the construct of national security. I'm going to ask you, Professor, the same question I asked Ken at the beginning of the debate, which is kind of a preparatory question, but it allows us to maybe get started to the different perspectives. And the question is, it's somewhat straightforward, but the question is, is the United States being invaded by illegal immigration? And you can interpret the word invasion any way you see fit. So pass the microphone to you, Professor Solman.
Thank you. First, I want to ask, can you hear me? Because I'm unfortunately talking over a phone connection because the Wi-Fi in the house currently does not work. And it took me some time even to get this phone connection going. I apologize for that annoyance. But if you can hear me, I'm more than happy to answer a question.
Loud and clear. We hear you loud and clear.
So the answer to the question is no, because illegal migration or drug smuggling or other similar activities, they may be problematic in various ways, but they are not invasion. As James Madison put it in discussing the invasion clause of the Constitution, invasion is an operation of war, meaning a large-scale armed attack of some sort from abroad, and migration just simply does not qualify as such. If it did qualify that way, it would raise drastic consequences, one of which is that as Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3 says, and as was previously discussed by Ken and others, that clause says that if there is an invasion, a state can engage in war in response, and it doesn't even need the authorization of federal government to do so. So if illegal migration qualifies as invasion or drug smuggling or something similar does, then states could start wars with neighboring countries without even getting authorization from federal government. In addition, the Constitution says that in times of invasion, the federal government can suspend the writ of habeas corpus, which in plain English means that they could detain people, including U.S. citizens, without charges, without any kind of due process or trial. And since in the modern history of the U.S., since we've had significant immigration restrictions, we've pretty much always had a significant amount of illegal migration. This would essentially give the power, the federal government, the power to suspend the writ of habeas corpus and detain people without charges or trials pretty much any time at once. If that sort of power was given to the federal government by the invasion clauses, or if the states could start to engage in war anytime they wanted merely because there's smuggling or illegal migration, one would expect this issue to be raised at the time of the Constitutional Convention and the ratifying convention. But in reality, if you go back to that period and you see all of the references to invasion, except for a few metaphorical references, and all those documents, the references are to invasion as an actual warlike military attack, as in the reference by James Madison that I just quoted. So there's many kinds of issues raised by problems at the border. You can argue about how they should be addressed. I think they can be best addressed by getting rid of the war on drugs and making legal migration easier. Others, you know, can certainly disagree, and that's a great debate to have. But what we should not do is adopt the dangerous position that this qualifies as an invasion, thereby authorizing states to engage in war without federal authorization and authorizing the federal government to detain people without charges or trial anytime it wants. I'm sure other points were made earlier, and I apologize that I wasn't there to hear them due to these technical issues.
No problem. I think that was a good way to kind of basically summarize another position. And I will allow Ken to do a quick retort on that position. I think which encompasses some of the things we did talk about before about what is warfare and how warfare can be defined beyond a nation state. Right. But nonetheless, we will give Ken the ability to retort. And at that point, we'll go back to the question from the. Go ahead, Ken.
So I'm not the only one to have cited James Madison's smuggler reference as demonstrating this clause of self-defense isn't restricted to nation states. But I would take you all back a little over 200 years to the adoption of the federal constitution. At that time, Georgia was the southwest border of the United States. Now, we didn't abut against a highly populated nation there in Georgia, but it's obvious why the governor of Georgia would have necessarily had the sole authority under the self-defense clause to decide whether Georgia was suffering an invasion or not, and to use whatever resources that the governor of Georgia believed were appropriate at that time. Would have taken months at that time to reach New York City, which was then the capital, and get a response, much less help, since the army at that time was about 100 people. It is And the advancement in technology and transportation for communication and the ability to know and respond doesn't change the locus of authority for constitutional decision making. So I think it is very helpful to think about how this would have actually played out and how it did actually play out in the founding period, and then to simply apply that to the modern era. That states would have substantial power vis-a-vis the federal government to defend their own borders, at least the border states. That, frankly, has been the most of the history. If you look at Texas, the Texas Public Policy Foundation has an excellent piece called The History of the Border, of the Texas Border. And for most of Texas's history, probably about half of it since it stopped being a republic, Texas has defended the Texas border. It is only really in the last 100 years or so that regular and meaningful presence by the federal government was brought into play in protecting that border. And you'll find, to a lesser extent, but similar history on the New Mexico and Arizona borders as well, where state authority was used and no one ever questioned it for 150 years. 100 years, it wasn't questioned. And until we get to this modern era, really our lifetimes, where there's this expectation the federal government is going to do everything, and it's a tragedy or a travesty if someone other than the federal government does it. The constitutional power to decide whether or not a state is being invaded has not changed since the Constitution was adopted. It was with the border governors then, and it is with the border governors today.
Can I make a couple brief points?
Yes, Professor. Maybe, and what I'll do, Professor, was I'll add in a question that was given by David Bryant, which falls within really the same.
Please go ahead.
And I'll read the question since I know you're on your phone. The question that was provided by David Bryant, who works at the office of the Texas AG, is, do you agree that the constitutional power of states to defend their borders would include defending against drug smuggling, human trafficking, and terrorist infiltration, even apart from illegal immigration in general? And then anything else you want to add, Professor, to respond to what Ken has just said?
So I think states have various powers over drug smuggling and certainly over terrorism and the like. I just deny that those powers come from the invasion clauses of authorization to quote unquote engage in war. But states obviously do have law enforcement authority of various kinds over a variety of different kinds of law breaking that fall short of waging war or being an invasion. And therefore states, can do various things, but obviously those are limited by constitutional constraints and sometimes by the superseding powers of the federal government. On James Madison and smuggling, that was not a reference to the invasion clause. That was a reference to the power to call forth the militia to enforce the laws. And again, there are various powers that both state governments and the federal government can have to restrict smuggling. Though I think in most cases, the way to deal with smuggling is to get rid of things like the war on drugs. Still, states could be more restrictionist than I would want on that. But that doesn't mean that smuggling qualifies as an invasion. It just means it would qualify as an ordinary law enforcement issue. On the issue of distance and time and the like, yes, certainly in the founding era and in the 19th century, it would take longer for the federal government respond to issues at the border than it would today. That doesn't mean that either then or now states had untrammeled power to decide what an invasion was and that nobody else could review that power. Rather, it just meant that as a practical matter, states would make an initial determination, but later federal authority could potentially countermand it. And it certainly doesn't mean that states could engage in war without federal restraint anytime they declare that there is an invasion. If they could do that, then there's very obvious that, you know, there's all sorts of abuses that could arise. Even if you trust red states to make those sorts of determinations, which frankly I don't, think about if a blue state could do it. If a blue state could decide, well, anytime there's, you know, un-PC activities that they don't like in a neighboring country, or that a neighboring country is contributing climate change or something, so, you know, they could start a war against them or whatnot by claiming that that's actually an invasion. So I think the bottom line is that when there is an actual invasion as defined by the text and original meaning, then states can engage in war in response. As a practical matter, in the 18th and 19th century, when the communications were worse or took longer than they do now, states might sometimes be able to get away with violating the Constitution in situations where the federal government couldn't immediately prevent them from doing so. But that doesn't make this provision any different from any number of other constitutional provisions where in an age of slower communication, states could sometimes get away with things because the feds couldn't prevent them from violating the law.
Good to go. Ken, do you have a response to that, or do you want to add anything?
Well, I appreciate the very practical what states could get away with perspective. That may not be technically legal, but it is real world from Professor Soman. We just have a fundamental disagreement here, and I've read a good chunk of the Virginia Convention, and I didn't just rely on James Madison. The person who really went at length on this subject was John Marshall. And I think there's this notion, because of where we are today versus, say, 200 years ago, that we just assume the court should decide everything. And that is not correct, nor was it correct at the founding. If you look at the Federalist Papers, you'll find lots of cautions against that, because that was one of the threats the Jeffersonians saw, was the dominance of the judiciary. Turns out they were pretty prescient in that regard. But the founders trusted people in the positions of the governors to make reasonable decisions, and they deposited the entire repository of authority over these subjects with those governors. And in 250, closing in on 250 years now, I don't think that any governor has ever done anything so outrageous along the lines that Ilya has described. That doesn't mean in the next 250 years somebody won't do something, but I don't think we should be designing for a perfect system. The system we have has worked. The states have defended their own borders. They have done so largely unchallenged until recent years. And when this case goes through, these cases, these types of cases, find their way to this Supreme Court, they're going to agree with Justice Scalia in Arizona v. U.S. when he noted that this clause leaves the states the inherent power to protect their territory, very much in answer to the sort of supplemental question that came from Mr. Bryant as well.
Sounds good.
So I guess we could probably go on for a long time. I don't want to hog the podium too much. I will merely say that, again, those other references are not actually referencing the invasion clause. And since Ken mentioned the Jeffersonians, the leading Jeffersonian was, in fact, James Madison, who specifically rejected the view migration could qualify as invasion. He said invasion is an operation of war in response to some arguments by the supporters of the Alien and Sedition Act to the contrary. As for how well our system has worked over time, I think there actually have been various abuses by governors, but to the extent that those have been constrained, it is in large part because, first of all, when this issue has come to the courts have actually pretty consistently rejected states' claims that illegal migration can qualify as invasion in decisions going back to the 1990s. In addition, the dominant understanding throughout most American history, indeed until this kind of argument started to be raised in the last couple of decades, was in fact that invasion is actually some kind of large-scale armed attack, not always from a state entity. It could be from a large terrorist group or a tribe or something, but that just illegal migration or smuggling doesn't qualify as an invasion. States could deal with things like smuggling through ordinary law enforcement, but they can't engage in war in response, nor can the federal government suspend the writ of habeas corpus in response. And I think to the extent that abuses by governors have been limited, it is because of that. I would note that since Texas was cited in the 19th century, Texas governors recognized that if the federal government concluded that there is, in fact, was not an invasion, that they would have to accept the federal determination on that.
Thank you. So there actually, I think, is a question here. And Professor Solomon, we earlier in the webinar, we discussed, actually Ken mentioned a Venezuelan transnational criminal organization called the Tren de Aragua. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but if not, it's basically a gang that was born out of the prisons in Venezuela that turned out to grow really fast, spreading throughout Latin America and now spreading throughout the United States. I think Ken referenced that it's grown exponentially faster than other gangs like MS-13 and others that are prominent in the U.S. In a fraction of the time. And so there's a question by David Vandenberg here in the chat that talks about what do the panelists anticipate about Tren de Aragua's goals? What do you think they are or want to expect to accomplish in the United States? And this ties into the broader debate of would these expected acts, if the Tren de Aragua is in fact, and I should mention that in Ken's remarks, he mentioned that the Tren de Aragua is potentially a informal or non-state arm of the Venezuelan government, meaning it's a state-sponsored criminal organization. So within that context, would a group like Tren de Aragua or Tren de Aragua itself, would their acts constitute as an invasion, just not a typical invasion by a military, but use of a proxy network to be able to erode the sovereignty of the United States? And that was the question that was posed by David Vandenberg. Professor Solomon, I don't know if you want to answer that first. And
sure.
Again.
So I probably answer it partially. Obviously, I don't know for sure what this gang's goals are because they don't generally consult with me or share with me their goals. However, from what I know of it, it sounds like a fairly typical organized crime organization. You know, they sell illegal drugs and the like and try to take control of an illegal market. Not much different from any number of other criminal organizations which function in illegal markets and are a product of our war on drugs. So while these are probably bad people, and in fact, many of them certainly are, and law enforcement should deal with them, they do not qualify as an invasion in the sense of an armed attack seeking to occupy U.S. territory. Like, rather, this is criminal activity of the sort that we often see with the war on drugs or previously with alcohol prohibition. During alcohol prohibition, there is large-scale alcohol smuggling by organized crime across both the Mexican and Canadian borders. That may have been a bad thing, but it was not an invasion, and neither is this an invasion. And I would note the involvement of government officials in ordinary criminality does not by itself make it an invasion either. Almost any time there's a large-scale black market, there's going to be some government officials on both sides of the border involved in it. To my mind, as I said before, the solution to these problems is to get rid of the war on drugs. That would immediately solve a lot of problems, including various border problems and eliminate opportunities for organized crime. If we choose not to do that, then states and the federal government can use ordinary law enforcement methods to, try to address the issue in other ways, though, those have their own costs. What they cannot do is pretend that this is an invasion that authorizes engaging in war, suspending the writ of habeas corpus, and other measures of that kind.
One quick follow-up question for someone, then we'll go to Ken. Let's just for argument's sake say, and I know obviously we're not all studying this specific gang, but for argument's sake, let's say that they are in fact a state-sponsored criminal organization, that they're getting their guidance and direction from a government. Does that change the equation at all, or is it still maintained as just, these are criminals doing bad things and they need to be punished by the laws that are on the book for law enforcement?
So it may require dealing with others, having other strategies than you would if government officials were not involved. But government officials' involvement in things like drug smuggling still does not convert drug smuggling into invasion. There is various kinds of hostile actions or bad things that governments can do that are reprehensible and blameworthy, but that don't qualify as invasion. Espionage is an example. Involvement in illegal smuggling may be another. Invasion, as James Madison said, is an operation of war. As far as I can tell, what this gang is doing does not qualify as that. They're just operating in an illegal market, one sadly that is the product of our own badly misguided policies in the war on drugs.
Okay, good to go. Ken, your response?
Yeah, so I want to clarify the source. The operation of war quote from James Madison is related to the Alien Sedition Acts, also 1798, like the Alien Enemies Act. I've already conceded that for the Alien Enemies Act, you do have a standard of nation state involvement that doesn't exist for the states to defend themselves with using the power they retained. They weren't granted it. They retained it, just like we retain the right to defend ourselves with the Second Amendment. It wasn't granted. It was retained. The states retain the right to defend themselves with Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3. And so, yes, James Madison talked about invasion differently at different times. But the discussions surrounding the Alien Sedition Act, the Alien Enemies Act, and so forth, utilized different definitions and tighter definitions that were focused on nation states that were not being used when the Constitution was drafted.
Sounds good. For the sake of time, there's a lot of questions, unfortunately, we're not going to get to on the Q&A box, but I do suggest that if you have a way, or if any of the speakers or panelists want to share their contact, perhaps they put their email in and you guys could take the conversation offline. But what I'll do, and I think both gentlemen have been on cable news networks before, so used to those 30 to 60 second sound bites, to perhaps provide a quick parting thought on to wrap up your position on just the going full circle back to the original question. Are we experiencing an invasion by illegal immigration in the United States? I'll go first to Ken, and then I'll give Professor Soman the last word on that same question. Again, very short. We have only a few minutes, less than 60 seconds. Ken?
Or yeah, so in looking at the fundamental question of the state's authority under the self-defense, what I've called the self-defense clause, I think it's very helpful to think of it back in the time it was first utilized, once the Constitution was enacted, and then to apply those conditions, by conditions I mean of decision and authority, to the present day. And while I hear lots of discomfort with the notion of states deciding to use war powers to defend themselves, that was the reality in 1789, and that authority still exists today. I believe that eventually we'll see a case work its way up to the Supreme Court. With the current Supreme Court, I would expect the kind of outcome we saw foreshadowed in Justice Scalia's concurrence in Arizona versus U.S., and I would expect the states to prevail in the ability to utilize that authority and power. Now, Professor Soman and I can disagree on what that outcome is or is will be or should be, because this hasn't been really litigated all the way up to this point. But in every instance where the question on the flip side for the federal government has been addressed, the courts have found it non-justiciable. And I fully expect that that is what they'll do with respect to the state exercise of power, and it is what they should do. And by the way, when a state starts to actually exercise this power, the deterrent effect alone will be quite helpful. I'm reflecting a little bit on some of the questions we didn't get to. People are asking about how else do you stop the flow. People don't come illegally if they don't think they can get in. It really becomes that simple. And I would say that from a simple efficiency standpoint, Texas, exercising its war powers under Article 1, can immediately return people back across the international boundary, where in many instances, if federal agents apprehend individuals, then they are automatically, or if, say, asylum is claimed, for example, automatically put in what amount to judicial processes that take a very long time and have us keeping those people here at our risk and at our cost as a nation. So there's very substantial benefits to the actual implementation of this state self-protection power.
Thank you, Ken. Professor Soman, you have the last word. Let's keep it to 1 to 2 minutes, please.
Sure. So the constitutional issue here is pretty simple. Invasion, as James Madison said, is an operation of war. It's an armed attack against the nation, a large scale one. Usually it is not simply illegal migration or drug smuggling. And by the way, when he said that, he was not referring to the Alien Enemies Act. He was referring to the Alien Friends Act, which had no such limitation as the Alien Enemies Act did. And therefore, he argued that it was not authorized by the invasion clause of the Constitution. And that usage of invasion was consistent during the founding period. You go the other way, you have drastic consequences, such as states being able to start wars on their own, the federal government being able to detain people anytime it wants, including U.S. citizens, without charges or trial. I'm very skeptical also, this doesn't determine the legal issue, but I'm very skeptical also of claims, well, if only states use these powers, that would suddenly end the illegal migration. The history of efforts to suppress large black markets by force is not a happy one. We've never been able to do it with any great success, whether it's with illegal migration or drug smuggling or alcohol smuggling during prohibition and the like. When you have a product, or in the case of migration, an opportunity in the market that millions of people want and can benefit from, if you suppress it, you just try to create opportunities for organized crime and disorder and other issues. Instead, we should learn from the experience of alcohol prohibition that it's better to not suppress these markets and instead let people interact freely. That is what will reduce the involvement by drug gangs, other criminals and the like, and enable the immigrants to not be a burden, but in reality to contribute to our economy and also better themselves. Regardless, whatever you think about the policy issues of illegal migration or of drug smuggling, you cannot deal with them as a constitutional matter by claiming that it's an invasion. And if courts allow that to happen, very bad consequences would follow. And it would go against the text and original meaning of the Constitution. Nor, by the way, would it even be following that concurring opinion by Justice Scalia, which was mentioned, because Scalia did not say there that illegal migration qualifies as invasion. He just said that under the original meaning, states have some power over immigration, whereas the federal government's power is actually very questionable whether they have power over it. And actually, you know, Scalia was to a large extent right about that, but that doesn't mean that illegal migration qualifies as invasion. Much more can be said, and I'm sorry I wasn't able to say some of it earlier because of my technical difficulties, but you know, I do say more in a couple of the readings that will be available, I think, on the website for this event afterwards, if they're not available already. I apologize once again for the technical issues that kept me from participating more fully. Thank you.
No, thank you, Professor Soman. And as they say, we have more to say, but we have no longer more, any more time. So unfortunately, we have to conclude the debate. I'd like to especially thank Ken Cuccinelli for your time and for all your arguments. I think they were very well articulated. Likewise, to Professor Soman, especially for kind of jumping through the technical barriers, but being able to join us in the end and providing very, very well articulated thoughts. But most importantly, I'd like to thank all the participants. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all your questions. Very good questions, actually, as I screened through them. But we'll hopefully continue this debate in further venues and in further opportunities. And then I will turn back to Edith at the Federalist Society. My name is Joseph Humeyer. I'm the Executive Director of Center for Security Society. It's been a privilege to be and accompany these fine gentlemen in this very, very important and, should I say, timely debate. And I don't believe this will be the last time we'll probably talk about this or you'll hear about this, because I think this is going to probably be among the most important issues that we're going to hear about all throughout the Trump administration, the incoming new president of the United States. So thank you again to the Federalist Society. Thank you to this panelists and speakers. And Edith, back to you.
Yeah, and just to echo that, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Ken and Professor Soman for speaking with us today and Joseph for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise. Thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your active participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.